Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 Starcast. Welcome to the Starcast for the week of September 14th, 2025. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer, and with me from Denver, Colorado, is my co-host, Mike Lewinsky. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Jay?
Good. A little wet down here this weekend, but it's all good. Let's take a look at some space weather from spaceweather.com. Mike, what's up with the sun over the next couple days?
Well, Jay, we have a pretty good chance to see a geomagnetic storm here today. They're calling this a 1-2 punch. Punch number one being a faint CME launched a couple days ago from the sun. And punch number two would be a stream of solar wind that is flowing from what they're calling the Big Butterfly Corona Hole. If you look at the coronagraph on spaceweather.com, you can see it does indeed appear to be a big butterfly, and it pretty much smack in the middle of the sun facing us. So there's a stream of solar wind that is headed towards the Earth, and these two may well combine to give us a G1 class storm, maybe even up to a G2 class storm. So officially, the forecast says here in mid-latitudes, we have about a 35% chance of an active condition with a 30% chance today, 20% chance tomorrow of a minor geomagnetic storm, whereas up at high latitudes, the chance bumps up to 65% chance of a severe geomagnetic storm in the next 24 hours, or 50% in the next 48 hours. So, there's a good chance tonight that we're going to see some northern lights.
Great.
So what's in our night sky this week, Jay?
It should be pretty good viewing conditions for a possible aurora, since our last quarter moon occurred here at about 6:33 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time this morning. So we're looking at a waning moon. And this week is also going to be great for observing the planets. There's a lot of them that are visible. Saturn's approaching its opposition, and Moon and Jupiter will be paired up on Tuesday morning. And then the Moon, Venus, and the star Regulus will be close together on Friday before dawn to the east. So for early morning planetary viewing, it's a great week. And finally, while it's still very dim at magnitude 14, the comet C24E1 Wurstz is in the group of stars known as the Corona Borealis, or the Northern Crown. So if you've got a bigger telescope, that's a nice comet to take a look at, and it may actually get a little bit brighter as time goes on. So now let's take a look at some space news, Mike.
Yeah, Jay, speaking of comets, there is a new comet temporarily named Swan 25b that was discovered on Friday, September 12th. By SOHO spacecraft's SWAN instrument, which is how it got its name. Initially shining at a magnitude of 7.4, it was not visible to the naked eye, but can be spotted with binoculars or a telephoto camera lens. Comet is currently in the constellation Virgo and best viewed by observers in the southern hemisphere, though it is gradually moving into a position that will make it more visible to us here in the northern hemisphere. Due to its proximity to the sun, it can be difficult to spot, but observers have been able to capture images and even see it with binoculars. Now, yesterday, multiple observers in the southern hemisphere did report that it is near magnitude 6, so about 3 times brighter than the day before, and it does appear to be getting brighter. So this brings up today's topic, where Jay and I are going to discuss comets. What are they? Where do they come from? And how are they named? And how can we best observe them? So Jay, what is a comet?
Well, a comet, is you can the probably the easiest definition is to say that it's a bright object with an apparent tail, and that's kind of what separates it from asteroids, which are also small bodies in space. And so those two things are comets and asteroids. And so the difference between comets and asteroids are where they come from and what they are made up of. And so a comet is, we think in most cases, is made up of mostly ice and a little bit of dust and small rocks. And so it's basically a dirty snowball is how we describe it. And so, and comets come from the outer limits of our solar system. And for the most part, they're in the Kuiper Belt and the further out from the Oort cloud. And so they are, that's the apogee of their orbits. And then they come into our solar system, and the perigee of their orbits is usually fairly close to the sun. And the difference between those and asteroids, or asteroids are bodies of about the same size as comets, but they are generally rocky. And so they're made up of types of rock. And they mostly orbit between the orbit of Mars and Jupiter. And they were once thought to be a planet that had broken apart due to Jupiter's gravity. However, that has been discounted, and it's basically a planet that has never actually formed out of the rocks, and due to again Jupiter's gravity keeping them from actually forming into a solid planet. So that. They and that's what we call the asteroid belt, and that's between Mars and Jupiter. And so comets come from much further out, and they orbit into our solar system. And they're also, we kind of name comets for inner that even though they are not maybe made of the ice or ice and dust or dirty snowballs. Sometimes we'll get interstellar objects like we have n now. We have 3I Atlas that we're not sh actually sure of the composition of, and we also kind of classify those as comets. And there's also some exceptions within the actual asteroid belt. There are some icy balls, dirty snowballs. That we call main belt comets, and so those are MBCs, and those are there's a few of those that are in orbit around in basically what the asteroid belt is, and so that's what comets are made of and where they come from, and how they get their tails is that as they get closer to the sun and they're exposed to the solar wind and solar radiation, whether it's infrared or other radiation, is that they're, the ice that the comet is made of starts to ablate or turn to gas. And so that goes directly from a solid to a gas. And that gas that is formed streams out away from the sun from the comet. And a common misconception is that the tail of a comet is following the comet's direction of movement, and that's not the case. It's actually a comet can be moving outward out of the solar system, and its tail would be facing outward out of the solar system or away from the sun. So the tail might actually be in the direction of travel of the comet instead of trailing behind the comet. So Mike, tell us a little bit about how comets are discovered and how they're named and and how we have gotten to know a little bit more about comets.
Sure, Jay. Two things before I dive into that. The dirty snowballs is sometimes also paired with snowy dirt balls. And so comet astronomers will divide comets into classes depending on how much ice there appears to be versus actual solid material. And also just to note that sublimation is the process of having the ice turn directly into gas, bypassing the water phase, or the liquid phase, I should say. So, as far as how comets are discovered and named, we today use, a combination of, although in most cases it's going to be photography, whether it's photography from a satellite or probe, or from a, ground-based telescope. And kind of one of the more famous comets of our lifetime was Shoemaker-Levy 9. And this comet was so famous and so dramatic because it impacted Jupiter in 1993. And sorry, 1994. And I remember this event very well. I had an 8-inch Meade Newtonian at the time, and I remember setting it up that evening and sitting in the front yard of a friend's house, trying to spot the impact. That telescope was really not up to the task, but it was, nonetheless exciting to see the photographs that were on the news at the time. So Shoemaker-Levy 9 was discovered by a trio of astronomers, Carolyn and Eugene Shoemaker and David Levy, in 1993. And it was located by a photograph taken from a 18-inch Schmidt telescope at the Palomar Observatory in California. And that was the first active comet observed to be orbiting a planet. So the photograph method, we would take a photograph and compare it with a photograph taken, say, the day before. And from that process, if something has appeared or moved against the background, we can infer that this is not, not a star, and not a known planet, because we know and can track where the planet should be. So when a new object appears, we can guess that this is most likely a comet or maybe an asteroid, and then go on from there. And I want to just kind of mention a little bit about the people who discovered it, in particular, Carolyn Shoemaker. She was very famous for her time, had discovered 32 comets and more than 500 asteroids. So she held the record for the most comets discovered by an individual at the time. And she did not start her career in astronomy until she was 51, and she kept it up until she was in her 80s. Her and her husband were visiting a impact crater in Australia and were involved in a tragic car accident that killed Eugene Shoemaker. She was injured but survived and continued her work up until in her 80s, until around 2002. And so, the naming of the comets is often credited to the observers, hence the Shoemakers and David Levy were the origin of the Shoemaker-Levy 9 name. Sometimes, as with the comet this week, Swan 25b, we have a comet named for the instrument that discovers or that first observes the comet. And that can be, useful in a case where you have a large team of people who are all working together to operate, and even governments that are, basically maintaining the instrument. So that's the sort of the lowdown, I did want to also, mention that in, ancient times, or even, let's say medieval times, the comets were not well understood. It was believed that they were omens, that they would signify great disasters coming. In fact, there was one emperor who, on observing a comet, had all of his, competitors executed summarily because, he felt that the comet was portending his, fall from his throne. And so the way to stay on the throne was just to kill anybody who might challenge it. But Tycho Brahe is sort of well known as an astronomer who, in 1577, made very detailed measurements of a comet that's now designated C1577B1. And Tycho Brahe helped to establish knowledge of what the comets were. There was a period of time where it was believed that, comets were in the Earth's atmosphere. And he, with his measurements, demonstrated very well that that was not the case. And his measurements also contributed to his protege, Johannes Kepler's laws of planetary motion. Those measurements were very useful for demonstrating that planets moved in elliptical or orbits. Now, we still had a heliocentric view of the universe in 1577, so not, some of what was documented then was, based on a fundamental, misconception about how the universe worked, that the sun was the center of the universe. But, that's how our science proceeds, is, little or moderate discoveries and measurements lead to suddenly the realization that no, the sun is not the center of the universe. So that was an important step along the way.
Yeah, we might note, that implies that, comets are visible to the naked eye. And so of the comets, on average, we can have a naked eye comet visible every year. It seems that, on average, there's a comet that is bright enough that it can be seen with the naked eye every year. So, and of course, there's the reoccurring comets that everybody looks forward to, like Halley's Comet. So, how do we best capture, and what's the best time to catch a comet?
And I also want to go back and just correct that Tycho Brahe was operating off of a geocentric view of the solar system, not a heliocentric one. So that was my mistake. Yeah, we often see them, right after sunset or before sunrise, because they're brightest when they are, closest to the sun. So it's not uncommon to be out and with binoculars. I find that, starting at a point early in sunset, and probably days before it's going to be naked eye visible with binoculars, searching in, or sunrise, searching in western sky at sunset or eastern sky at sunrise, attempting to get a fix with binoculars on, the faint object, so that I get a better idea the next day where to look. And of course, I'll, have cameras out doing time lapse in that same vicinity. And I'll be periodically reviewing the frames in case the object does show up in photographs but is harder to spot with binoculars. And I find that, getting a fix on, where roughly from my position I'm going to see it on the horizon, from what night to night, it starts to get easier and easier to spot. And, because it's going to appear in, roughly the same point along the horizon, maybe a little bit earlier the next night, or a little bit later if it's at sunset, a little bit, be visible a little bit later. So I do like to track over several nights. And you know, with the most dramatic comets, you know, I'll have two cameras, one wide field, one telephoto. I'll have the C star pointed there, you know, maybe even my other telescope and a pair of binoculars, and you know, be scrutinizing the horizon. You know, and you never know what's going to happen and how if the weather's going to prevent me from seeing it the next night. So I'll take every opportunity I get to start hunting early, so that when it starts to become a more impressive sight, I am well prepared for capturing it from, you know, if possible, before, you know, twilight, right up until it sets.
Yeah, and so, yeah, you know, of course, with Swan 25B, which is and this was totally undiscovered until it appeared basically next to the sun, and they were able to, you know, people that were observing the sun, you know, said, "Oh my gosh, here's a new comet that we haven't seen before," and this one is going to be, you know, probably going to be visible here really soon. For most of our viewers and listeners. And one of the things about that's a challenge with doing astronomy or astrophotography of comets is because their movement is not like star movement. And so, in other words, if you have a telescope that has the sidereal tracking to track the stars so that they don't blur, is if it were to try to track a comet and then had a stable vision of the stars, the comet would appear to be blurred, or you know, it'd be, you know, kind of blurry and not well defined. And however, if you concentrate on the comet and track the comet with your telescope, then the stars that are around it, because they're not moving in the same direction relative to the comet, is they appear as streaks. So often when you see photographs of comets, you will see that the stars are actually kind of streaky. And one of the things that's really cool about, well, first of all, you know, the planetarium software like that is out there is constantly updated, and so that if you go to your favorite planetarium software, and they will often update it with a comet when it appears. So I noticed it in for the C star in their star databases, they just added Swan 25B to the database. So now, you can actually take a smart telescope like the C Star and say, target Swan 25B, and it's going to go to that and actually track the comet, instead of actually tracking just with you know, stars around it. So that's pretty cool, huh, Mike?
It is. And Jay, you've reminded me of a couple of things I wanted to add into our discussion here. One is that one of the reasons why Carolyn Shoemaker had as many discoveries as she did is that she had very good stereoscopic vision, and this is helpful for detecting nearer objects. One way you can do this is to take two photos taken from different times and put them together into a, you know, a viewer that will project them both so that you can see both of them superimposed. And she was very adept at picking out objects that had some apparent motion in that stereoscopic view. Also, we kind of skipped, or, you know, we made some reference to the origins in the original nebula of the solar system. And we would be remiss in not talking a little bit about the Rosetta mission. Rosetta was a probe that was launched to study a comet. It has a Russian name, and I've now lost my link here. But Rosetta sent, it was the first probe to actually land on a comet, and really helped us understand more about the origins of comets. So, there was some debate. Were these really truly just the accretion of gas and dust from the early nebula that our sun formed out of? Or did some of the what they call Neptunian objects or TNOs, did some of these larger objects collide and fragment and create comets? And what Rosetta and the lander Philae determined really helped us to understand, at least with the particular 67P. It was Churyumov-Gerasimenko 67P was the comet that the Philae lander took observations of. And we found that that this was a the comet has sort of lobes that you have these smaller objects that have accreted together, and it's fairly loosely accreted. There is not evidence that substantial thermonuclear decay or radioactive decay has changed or transformed the comet. And all of our planets have undergone substantial changes because of gravity and radioactive decay. Their chemical composition has been substantially changed over their lifetimes, whereas the comets, being these loose aggregations of material that are very, very cold, very, very far from the sun for most of their existence, are apparently, we can think of them as, nebula fossils almost. They show us what the very early solar system, even before we had much sun, looked like or was composed of. So there's a lot we can learn by studying comets and their compositions.
Yeah, and so when you say very cold, we're talking near absolute zero. So things happen very slowly at those temperatures.
That's right. That's right. I also wanted to add, Jay, that this Swan 25b discovered by the SOHO Solar and Heliospheric Observatory has been a mission that has discovered more than 5,000 comets. And because it is a solar and heliospheric observatory, it is well positioned to detect comets that are just passing the sun that were too dim until they started to heat up. So more than 5,000 comets discovered by SOHO, which was a European Space Agency spacecraft launched in 1995. It's been making observations since 1996 and continues to operate after 29 years in space. Mission is extended until the end of this year and subject to review. So how much longer we're going to have this instrument is still to be determined.
Yeah, and this, and the SOHO is also has given us great pictures of the sun's corona, and because it has that the solar mask on it, where it just basically blacks out and makes kind of its own eclipse in its images, and that's how we get a lot of the coronal imaging of the sun. Just a side note on that particular on SOHO. Do we expect any naked eye visibles comets this year?
I think Swan is probably our greatest chance, but we can get surprised. These things do tend to kind of sneak up on us because until they start heating, we just don't know that they're there. And suddenly, there's a little bit of a tail forming and enough reflection off of that tail. These tails can grow to millions and millions of miles in length, so they can be impressively large. And then, of course, we did mention the 3I Atlas. Interplanetary comet. I don't have any idea whether that composition is going to turn it into a naked eye visible. I would be ecstatic if we could actually get some viewing for an interstellar comet. That would be spectacular. And I'm hoping, very hoping.
Yeah, and the comet I mentioned earlier that's actually in the Corona Borealis right now, Weir shows, or C2024 E1 Weir shows, they're saying that that one is going to brighten up in December, and they're anticipating it to be in the magnitude 6 range in December, so that may be naked eye visible as well.
It'd be very exciting.
Yeah, and it's funny, that we can name some of the comets that we've seen over our lifetime. And I remember Hale-Bopp, I remember Shoemaker-Levy, and I remember Neowise. And
And
what are some of the more memorable comets that you can remember?
yeah, Hiakatake was another comet that was in the 90s. It was like we had Hale-Bopp and then we had Hiakatake. I don't recall the exact order that those happened, but Comet Hiakatake was discovered in January of 1996 and was prominent that year. Of course, Hale-Bopp, that was the one that we had our death cult, right? That was the one that the Heaven's Gate folks were believed that there was a UFO that was going to take them away. Yeah, Hale-Bopp was discovered in 95. So we had sort of back-to-back years of very spectacular comets. I want to also mention I had an experience one night. I was living up in Nederland outside of Boulder, and I was outside late. I happened to have my telescope out. It was not actively observing with the telescope at the moment, but suddenly I saw this thing appear in the sky that looked like a comet, but I was absolutely dumbfounded because it was visibly moving through the night sky. And comets being where they are, do not appear to move against the background of the stars in short duration. From night to night, you can, or over the course of a night, you can see a small, very small amount of motion, apparent motion. But this traversed the night sky in about 3 minutes, directly across the night sky. And it looked like, by every indication, it was a comet. And I remember that neighborhood dogs started barking at the sight of this. This was not just something that I saw and my friends who were with me observing saw, but the dogs saw it too. And I managed to get my telescope, and it was hard to track with, an 8-inch, but I was able to very briefly observe it through the telescope as it was moving, and I had to manually track. And the telescope did not answer for me what this was, but I knew that this could not be a comet, and I was just mystified. And so this would have been in the era of Hale-Bopp and Hiakatake, probably about 97, 98. And so I went to Usenet, which was a forum or a series of forums that almost it really predated the World Wide Web, but it was an internet resource. And I went to a astronomy part of Usenet, and I posted a question: what was this that I saw? And this was still in the early era of the internet, and I got answers, and some of the answers were way out there, but I got several people who concurred that with each other that what I witnessed was the space shuttle executing a water dump or flushing their toilets. And so the apparent tale was, in fact, the water that was being ejected from the space shuttle looked just like a comet. And I knew enough to know that this couldn't possibly be a comet.
Yeah, and that goes to remember earlier this year that we both observed the what it was called the Great Streak, and
Yes.
that was exactly that sort of thing, which was a Chinese satellite or Chinese spacecraft venting fuel, right?
Right. And I will say that there was much less volume coming out of the space shuttle, so it was a much shorter tail. There was still a distinct tail, but it was not nearly as long as our Chinese rocket propellant vent. And I think it just had to do with, probably both volume and altitude and speed that created such a very long tail from the I think it was May that we saw that.
Yeah, and so when you're so if you're out observing and you think you see a comet, but it's moving fairly quickly, chances are that it is not a comet. A comet would you would be kind of observe the movement over several days, and so especially with all the SpaceX launches out of Vandenberg and also on the East Coast out of Cape Canaveral. Is that we're seeing a lot of these rocket launches or staging or fuel dumps and that sort of thing that actually kind of appear to be comets because but they're kind of short-lived phenomena.
That's right. That's right.
And of course and the big difference between a comet and an asteroid is if when an asteroid hits our atmosphere and becomes a meteor. Is it can have a tail as well, but again, that is a very short duration event, and it may be 3 or 4 seconds would be a long fireball event, and again, it would be an object with a tail, but it would not be a comet. We also both photographed a reentry of a spacecraft, the
Crew Dragon.
yeah, that Crew Dragon trunk. We both Mike and I photographed the reentry of that, and that was almost the it was fairly long duration. It was over it was like 3 minutes duration with a fireball with a huge burning tail.
Yeah, that was really once in a lifetime event, I think.
Yeah, well, let's kind of hope so. Is if we get too many of those reentries, that might be a bad thing for our atmosphere and
Agreed.
other things. All right, so that's kind of our take on comets today, and I want to thank all of our listeners for checking out this podcast, and be sure to comment, like, and subscribe, and let us know what you'd like to hear more about. You can also check out our individual websites. Mike's is wildernessvagabonds.com, and mine is skylapser.com. And if you'd like to help us out, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/skylapser. The intro music is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library. And from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory, this is Jay Schaefer and
Mike Lewinsky.
Wishing you all clear skies.